Here are four things that you really need to know if you're trying to improve your English. I'm Joseph, this is Input English. If you are going to take on this magnificent quest of learning another language, in this case, English, if you're going to invest your valuable time, then we want this process to be effective and efficient. For all of us language learners, when it's all said and done, we want to have learned our language. We want to have established proficiency. Today, I'd like to discuss four things that you should know in order to make certain that your learning of English is effective and efficient. The Input English channel produces comprehensible input content for English language learners. If you can follow these stories and discussions with enough exposure to the English language, you will acquire it. This channel does not focus on memorizing vocabulary or studying grammar rules. So let's get started with our four important points you need to know. Number one, our brain is not a computer. Our brain did not evolve for mass storage of data. If we operate on the false assumption that our brain is just a storage facility for facts, then our results will not be satisfactory. In the field of cognitive psychology, research shows that the human brain is very good at remembering things, but that memory strength is related to how well the new information is connected with things we already know. If something new we learn is poorly connected to what we already know, we will have trouble remembering it. So if our brain is not a computer for mass storage of information, what is it? Our brain evolved for survival. Our brain evolved so that we could compete for food, avoid being killed, and reproduce. Humans are actually quite good at those things. Our brain is very capable of making connections, recognizing patterns, and predicting the future. Now, when I say predicting the future, I'm not talking about a fortune teller predicting the future years in advance. I'm talking about our ability as humans to look at a pattern of facts, look at the situation, and estimate what's likely to happen next. Our ability to do this short-term prediction of what's likely to happen next had great survival value. The fact that our brain is not just a computer for mass storage is related to an interesting dichotomy of human experiences. Virtually every human being learns one language. When a baby is born, that baby is exposed to the parent's native language, and over a period of years, that baby acquires that language, and if they go to school, long before they went to school, they were fluent. Fluency in our primary language has nothing to do with going to school. In stark contrast to our incredible ability to acquire our primary language, when people try to learn languages in school, the failure rate is approximately 99%. It is uncommon for a student in a school system to learn a language to proficiency. Now, because of that observation, it was suspected that it was the age of the language learner that made the big difference. We saw the critical age theory come into vogue. It was recognized that small children have great neuroplasticity, and the critical age theory assumes that after a certain age, one can't learn a language. The critical age theory was used to explain the failure of public education to help people learn a second language. There are a couple of major flaws with this critical age theory. One is they were comparing apples to oranges. They were comparing the experience of a child who absorbed the language from input from their family and the other people surrounding them during their early development versus people trying to acquire a language by learning its structure, memorizing vocabulary, memorizing grammar rules, memorizing the exceptions to the grammar rules, and trying to figure out how to pronounce words. What we learned, mostly during the 20th century, was that teaching people the structure of the language and having them memorize vocabulary and grammar is not very effective. So the flaw with the critical age theory on this point is they were comparing two different learning methods. The other big flaw with the critical age theory is it provides us with no benefit. If a person wants to learn a language and they are 30 years old, the critical age theory tells them not to bother, that it won't work. And that's not useful. I would submit that the critical age theory was just a giant roadblock. It's been largely discredited. Instead, we recognize that children do have a great deal of neuroplasticity, but there is no evidence that adults cannot learn languages. One of the interesting flaws with teaching languages by rote methods based on memorization is it doesn't take advantage of the actual structure of the human brain, the actual function of the human brain. In general terms, a human being can focus their attention on one thing at a time. They can keep a half a dozen things in their short-term memory. Education by rote methods requires the person to pay attention to one thing, put it in their short-term memory, and then strive to convert that into long-term memory by repeated drills. This is a very inefficient system, and it doesn't work very well. The reason it doesn't work is because when we take an isolated fact and run it through that process, the connection in our memory is very weak. If we learn the word pelota in Spanish to be equal to a ball, that's just one connection in our brain. It might be enough to get a question right on a test, but it's not enough that you would be able to remember that word when you're constructing a sentence talking to a native speaker a year from now. Those weak connections disappear. We lose the ability to retrieve those facts that we've learned that way. So how did this all come about? How did we get in this situation? We got here because of the Industrial Revolution. In the early 1800s, the Industrial Revolution was taking hold in various countries, and it became clear that these developing industries were going to need workers. Countries, governments, institutions decided to create a massive public education program to produce workers to work in these factories and these businesses. Since these educational systems were funded and managed, usually by governments, accountability was built into their design. They needed to be able to test the students to make sure that they had attained a level of proficiency. Gradually, school systems like what we see today evolved from that necessity to generate workers for the Industrial Revolution. Now, that evolution continues, and at this point, in developed countries, the educational systems are not only to produce factory workers, but the methods of education in classrooms are still tied to that old-fashioned approach of focusing your attention on one thing, putting it in short-term memory, trying to get it into long-term memory with the goal of test performance a few days later. Long-term ability to retrieve that information is not very good. This is one of the ways classroom language learning fails terribly. So where do we go with this? What's the solution? Well, if you follow this channel, you know what I'm likely to say here. Comprehensible input. But there's really more to the story than that. Certainly, comprehensible input is the way we all learned our first language. If you look back in history and examine how people learned before the development of large educational systems, you will quickly discover that much of that learning was based on stories. Information was passed down through generations by stories, fables, myths, songs, and all of this information evolved along with the human brain. This approach to learning with stories goes back to antiquity. It probably goes back to prehistoric times. Most good comprehensible input amounts to stories. Good input includes true stories, fictional stories, and discussions that are very much like stories in their creation. Stories and discussions used for comprehensible input take advantage of the way our brain evolved. Our brain evolved to make connections, to recognize patterns, and predict the future on the short term. So if you're following a story, you automatically are seeing patterns in that story. You're automatically making connections between what's happening in the story and your own experience. A well-told story has the listener or the reader speculating subconsciously about what is likely to happen as the story progresses. This active engagement of the listener is magical for the learning process. In contrast to rote learning that we've talked about, stories can elicit an emotional response. We can see connections between the story and our feelings. This response is a subconscious response. I would submit that this recruitment of our subconscious into the learning process is important because it gives us a lot more bandwidth for learning. In modern education, the subconscious mind does not get much attention for a very simple fact. It's very difficult to test. You can't quantitate it, but it's still very real. We process information from stories with our conscious mind, but also our subconscious mind. This is important for us to understand metaphors, symbolism, that is, hidden meanings, and the emotional dimension of the story. Stories are also very important for us to get along with each other. Through stories, we learn to consider what other people are thinking, what they are feeling, what their motivations might be, and what their needs might be. Stories support the development of empathy. So now we can recognize that the brain is not a computer for mass storage. Our brain is designed for recognizing patterns, making connections, and short-term prediction of the future. We have recognized that classroom teaching of language has not been very effective. We recognize that our educational system was developed because of the Industrial Revolution, but that our brain actually evolved for survival. And that's a major disconnect. And we can recognize that ideally, we should not just employ our conscious brain activity to learn language, but we should recruit our subconscious as well. So with those revelations, where do we go? Well, the answer is hidden right here in plain sight. Comprehensible input. One of the practical problems with comprehensible input is it does not enjoy huge marketing and advertising budgets. There are people using the term online, but you don't see major corporate sponsors. There are no huge marketing campaigns to push comprehensible input. It's much more grassroots. Corporations are not pumping money into efforts to build content for comprehensible input. That gives us an interesting challenge. We have to recognize that comprehensible input is effective, it's worth our time, it will generate the results, but we have to discover it. Then we have to learn how to use it. The way we use comprehensible input is very individualized. One of the important things we learned from Stephen Krashen was that self-selection of input is super important. Recall in school, you read what you were told to read. You memorized what you were told to memorize. It was very directed by the teacher and the educational system. Research on this topic shows that if you compare input that is prescribed versus input that is self-selected by the language learner, learning is approximately 3 times better for self-selected input. This gives us a layer of complexity that bothers some people. Based on our experience with public education, we are used to being spoon-fed the information that we need to learn. That isn't the way it works best with comprehensible input. Ideally, you consume the input that captures your imagination, that captures your attention, and input that you can actually understand. Because of that, there is no one-size-fits-all for input. I can't create a curriculum that will work optimally for everyone. With English, we have a lot of people learning English who have a basis from their school years. It is common for people to study English in a classroom for many years without attaining fluency. People who have studied a language in school are false beginners. They're not proficient in the language, but they have a vocabulary. They have an idea of how the language works. And so they are not true beginners. They can use what they learned in school to get a grip on the input and make the input that they are receiving more comprehensible. This is a very common pattern for English learners. When I created this channel, I recognized all of this. So I made a lot of different types of videos to make sure that there was some variety there so that there was something there for everyone. I created a lot of stories because stories should be the heart of good input for language learners. We evolved learning stories. Understanding stories is baked into us. As you use comprehensible input to learn English or improve your English, you need to identify content that is useful to you. Now, we've talked many times about the need for content to be understandable, not too difficult. It needs to be interesting. The subject matter needs to be something that you're interested in. And the presentation needs to be compelling. It needs to be presented to you in a way that your imagination and your attention are captured. You want input that's hard to put down. When we are learning languages, it's very tempting to slip back to traditional methods. Look up grammar rules. Look up different words. Maybe watch videos about grammar rules. And the problem with that is it actually decreases our efficiency. It actually interferes with our learning. When I used comprehensible input to learn Spanish, I nearly never looked up a word. Instead, I found content that I could understand and then learned the words in context. And the last issue that can carry over from our time in school and interfere with our use of comprehensible input is our picture of the timeline. In school, the cadence of learning and testing was very quick. We would memorize something, and days later it would be tested, and then we could forget it. That experience in school frequently gave us an impression of relative speed in learning. Comprehensible input is really the opposite. It's a very gradual process. You don't get immediate feedback of progress. Basically, with comprehensible input, you just have to trust the system and keep getting input. Now, in another video, I tried to give you a perspective about willpower. As magnificent as willpower is, it has its weaknesses because it can fatigue. Comprehensible input can be a test of our willpower because it takes willpower to select a long-term benefit. It takes willpower to trust the system in the face of little feedback. And as we know, willpower can be fatigued over time. As I mentioned that, most of you would anticipate that my next recommendation is to recognize the limitations of willpower and use what willpower you have to make habits, trusting your program more to habits rather than the ongoing use of willpower, which can fatigue. I have done this myself and found it very successful. I invite you to go through the video library on this channel. We now have more than 325 videos for you to use as comprehensible input. A lot of people are making use of that library, going through each video or nearly each video, and frequently watching them more than once. This was a pattern I used learning Spanish. I would watch a video and then a week or two later, watch it again. I always found that I learned something by the second watching. My understanding always improved. I hope you find these concepts useful to you. I invite comments below, and if you like videos like this, be sure to click on this one next. See you soon.